I'm Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County, and we're at Grace Hudson on June 2nd, 2018. Can you introduce yourself?
Kate Babcock Magruder.
Where were you born?
I was born in Chicago in 1951, grew up in Woodstock, Illinois, about an hour northwest of Chicago, in the woods.
Where were you when you decided to come to Mendocino County?
Well, I was in those woods, living in a teepee in my parents' kind of woods in outside Woodstock, Illinois. It was 1972, and I was in my mother's kitchen because I wasn't really living in the teepee. I would just go sleep in the teepee. So I was in the kitchen, and I got a call on our landline from our friends in Laguna Beach, California. I was in Illinois with my partner Bob, whom I'd met at college, and we were headed to Maine to buy land and go back to the land. And we were going to buy land right by Helen and Scott Nearing because we'd read their book and we'd gone to visit them a couple of times in Maine, and we wanted to be their best friends. And so that's where we were headed, and we were making money at little jobs in Woodstock. And these friends from Laguna Beach, with whom we lived a few years earlier, and we'd been partners in a natural food store in Laguna Beach with them, and they had heard of this piece of property outside someplace called Ukiah, California, and it was a ranch called Greenfield Ranch, and it was being subdivided. And they'd heard about it because a friend of theirs in Berkeley had seen a little 3x5 card on the bulletin board of the Berkeley Co-op saying, "People who want to buy land, call me." And that was Tim Baker, who was putting this deal together in the 1971. We heard about it in 72. Our friends from Laguna had already gone up to visit Greenfield Ranch and said it was beautiful. And did we want to come back and buy a piece of property with them there? And I remember that moment, kind of, it's like in the continental divide of my life, whether I would go east to Maine or back to Northern California, where I'd never visited, never been above San Francisco, but it wasn't really a tough decision, knowing winters. And so we said sure, and we sent our hard-earned little money, because it was not very expensive at the time to buy land. We sent it back, and we were all of a sudden part owners of parcel 13 on Greenfield Ranch. And so we went back to Laguna for the winter and then moved. We saw Greenfield Ranch for the first time on Christmas Day, 1972. And then we moved with that same teepee to Greenfield on Easter, 1973.
What were you expecting to find when you came here?
I hadn't gotten that far. I knew that I wanted to help Bob build a house and make a garden and live happily for the rest of our lives. That was pretty much as far as I'd gotten. When we bought into Greenfield Ranch, it was an association. It was a nonprofit organization that Tim Baker had set up, and one had to buy in literally to the bylaws of the association, which meant that there was agreements that you were making with all the other people who were buying land on Greenfield Ranch. And when you bought in, you had in common then 200 acres of Greenfield, which included the original ranch house and a wonderful dammed up pond and a lot of, 200 acres of land around all of that you held in common. So there had to be general meetings every month to make the decisions and to decide, whether the roads were getting fixed and what culverts needed to be put in and any of the myriad decisions that had to be made when all of a sudden you were living cooperatively with a group of people you never met.
So what were those meetings like? How did you figure out how to govern yourselves and make rules and enforce them?
I have a copy of a letter that I wrote home to my parents after the first general meeting that I went to in April of 1973. it's a long, long letter on legal paper, and I was just horrified by the general meeting because all the decisions had to be made by consensus, which wasn't easy, and there were kind of irrational points of view that were exhausting, and you had to just hammer it out, and it just seemed, it was exhausting, and I didn't have the makeup for it. I didn't have the mettle. And I remember in the letter that I wrote home to my parents that it was worse than student council, and that I didn't know if I could take it. I didn't know if I was up to the challenge, you know, what it was going to mean to hammer out decisions month by month with a group of people that you really didn't have anything in common with, except that you all of a sudden were living on the same large piece of property that you were managing together.
Is there a particularly memorable moment or moments from the experience of the general meetings?
I remember kind of a feeling of despair because one of the bylaws was no hunting, no dogs and no hunting. And I had been a vegetarian already for a few years, and that seemed proper and understandable to me that there wouldn't be any hunting. And so in one of those first meetings, there was a family who'd moved to the ranch, Troll and Marilyn, and they had many children. And they, you know, we were all kind of, none of us had many resources, and it was difficult to, you know, to have enough food and to have enough, you know, supplies that you needed, and they were finding it difficult. And Troll, who was a hunter, felt like it was going to be important for him to try to get some meat for his family to, and he wanted to, I remember in his phrase, he wanted to take a deer. He stood up at the meeting and he said, "I'm going to have to take a deer." And the alarm and the horror that rippled through the meeting, it was like, that's not part of the agreement, that we can't do that. That's against the bylaws. That's against the rules. And it was a long, bitter conversation that unfolded. And I don't know that it was ever resolved. Probably Troll did take a deer. I mean, how are we going to know? Everybody was living fairly far apart from each other. This is a 5,400 acre ranch, so people were living, you know, miles from each other. You didn't really see what people were doing. So I hope he did take a deer in retrospect, because as it turned out, of course, the deer population burgeoned when there was no hunting, and that was not a happy, you know, circumstance either. So we learned, you know, why there were, you know, natural rules kind of set in place for you know, for animals and predators. People had gardens and deer needed to eat too. And so people's gardens, you know, were often ravaged by deer. And yeah, that's why it was unhappy. And then, you know, there were diseases that when there's too many deer, you know, the animals get sick. And, you know, ticks then became a big issue, not because there were so many deer, I don't think, but there were lots of ticks. Ticks and Lyme disease became a kind of an epidemic on the ranch and a scourge of the ranch, Lyme's disease. So, I don't know it, to tell you the truth, because I didn't live on Greenfield Ranch very long, so I don't know what the rules are now regarding hunting. But I imagine they've come to some kind of compromise at general meetings.
So how did you do your back to the land homesteading situation? How did you figure out how to get food and figure out your water situation?
I came here with Bob Currier, and he had grown up in Temple City, a little suburb of Los Angeles. And I'd grown up in the woods outside Woodstock, Illinois, but I didn't have any skills. I was an okay writer, and yeah, that wasn't helping me too much. I remember Bob and I went to see Pete Passoff at the, what would that have been? It was an a county administration building office. He was farm advisor, perhaps he was in the farm advisor's office, and we went there early on after we moved here to say, you know, what can we grow? What can we grow? This is where we're living up on Greenfield Ranch, right next to the Singley Ranch. And, you know, what can we grow? And Pete Passoff looked at us with kind of fatigue. And I think he'd already talked to many people like us who'd been coming into the county with the same kind of like starry-eyed optimism. And he said, well, you can't grow very much up there, but you can paint pictures. Can you paint pretty pictures? And so we kind of skulked away from Pete Passoff and made our garden. And we lived in the teepee for that summer of 73. And we found out, like many people had discovered, that there were old primo redwood, like old growth redwood chicken houses in Petaluma that had been built during the chicken heyday in Petaluma when it was the egg basket of the world. And they weren't being used anymore. And so my grandmother was living in Petaluma at the time. So we would go down and stay with my mother's mother in Petaluma. And we found a Japanese woman who allowed us to take apart one of her old redwood chicken houses. And we did that over the course of a couple months, I guess, and hauled up in our 1953 Chevy truck. We hauled up back up to Greenfield Ranch all the tongue and groove redwood boards that were covered with ancient chicken shit, and we stacked them. And you know, for a couple of months there, as we approached the fall, the rainy season, my big job was to have a bristle brush, a heavy duty bristle brush, and I would like scrape the old chicken shit off the wood while Bob would read this book called oh, darn it, I can't think of it. It was a wonderful book about building your homemade house that was very simple. And it was just a rectangular one-room house with a slant roof facing south with window seats on the south side and a loft bed and a loft above the window seat. So there were plenty of places for people to rest and sleep. And our closet was underneath the loft bed. And it was very cozy. And we found a little wood cook stove and we had our sink. We hauled water for the first year, at least. We hauled in 5-gallon drums from town. We hauled water, or sometimes we probably would filch it from the ranch house, as many people were, which it was not popular. wasn't a very popular thing to do. But we built our house then in the fall. We had the roof on. It was tight. By the time the rains came in November, it rained every day straight for 36 days that fall. And our friends from Laguna Beach came up to live with us in the one room. It was very cozy. And I remember we all lived together in that one room. We had an outhouse under this circle of ancient bay laurel trees, which was a very, very resonant kind of, it was just a powerful kind of energy field around these old bay laurel trees in a circle, and that's where our outhouse was. And we were all stuck in this little room during the rains, and it just poured, and you couldn't drive anywhere because the roads were bad anyway, and they quickly turned to impassable red mud. And we read out loud to each other, and I remember that first fall we read out loud Inside the Third Reich. That was one of our favorites. And Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut. And here's a little interesting story. I began to feel not very well. I just began to feel kind of puny. And I began to feel that I had a finger pressing on my throat. It was a very strange, it was a pressure on my throat. And it was really the sense of a finger pressing on it. And I didn't know what was going on. And we were going to go home for Christmas, Bob and I. We were going to fly back to Illinois for Christmas, to my family's home. And but we had stocked our house, our little cabin with 50-pound bags of wheat berries and garlic that we were going to plant when we came back, you know, after Christmas. And, you know, we were all set. We were going to live there forever. We were set. We had our stuff. And I ended up telling my parents right after Thanksgiving, I think, I called them from the only phone there was, which was a pay phone at the ranch house, that I just didn't feel very good. And they immediately leapt into the fray and said, well, come on home now. Come home now early and we'll check you out at the Woodstock Hospital. And so I got on a train. I got a little sleeper compartment and took this train from Oakland back to Chicago. And the moment I got on that train, I felt happy. I felt free. I didn't feel so sick. And I had my notebook with me, my journal, and I began to write. And I realized, I remember thinking, I haven't written in my journal all summer. This is interesting that now all of a sudden I feel like writing. And so I was writing in my journal and I got home and I went to the hospital and there was nothing. They couldn't find anything wrong. There was nothing wrong with me. But I continued to have this pressure. And when my dear friend and partner, Bob Currier, arrived at my house shortly before Christmas, I was sitting on the living room floor in my parents' house doing yoga, I think, and he burst in the front door. And the moment I saw him, I heard this voice in my head say, "You have something stuck in your throat that you have to tell him." And what I realized in that moment was that I had to tell him I couldn't go back to Greenfield Ranch after Christmas, that I couldn't live that life, that I could not do it, that I was... The thought that occurred to me was I was sleepwalking on his life. Certainly it was something I thought I wanted to do with him, and indeed I did, but I hadn't found my own real path to do it. I was just kind of doing what he was doing. I was scraping the shit off the redwood, you know, redwood boards. I wasn't directing my own life. I didn't have control of it. And that was very concerning to me. And so I told him that I couldn't go back. And we spent a very rocky winter together in Woodstock because he didn't go back either. We were very, very, very close. We were kind of joined together at the hip. And we couldn't leave each other. It was a really interesting thing. So we stayed and we worked at a factory in Woodstock, at a drill bit factory outside Woodstock. That was a high moment of my life. And then eventually in the spring, he drove back and spent the summer in on the ranch, and I spent the summer in Woodstock running a theater program, which was my background. And then by the time that summer was over, I so missed him. That was good. I so missed him, and I so missed Greenfield that when I came back to visit in September of 74, I came back to Greenfield, and I was so happy to be there, and it just seemed idyllic. You know, kind of once again, as it had in the early months that I'd lived there. And we ended up, my Bob and I ended up for like 4 more years going back to Greenfield in the summer and back to Woodstock, Illinois in the winter and doing theater in the schools in the winter, until finally by 76, I thought, I got to make a decision. Where am I living? Am I living in Illinois or am I living in Northern California? And it was again a really clear choice, so I came back. But I couldn't live on the ranch for very long, and I quickly decided I needed to come down into town and find a job. I didn't know anybody except one person that I'd met in Laguna Beach years earlier, but within minutes practically I met Susan Bell at the community center, and she offered me a job for like $1 an hour, but I'll take it. And then she said, there's a CETA grant. CETA was a federal program at the time, and it was CETA, and it stands for Comprehensive Educational Training Act. It was the Jimmy Carter program, and he was, I think it was as close to the WPA as anything I've heard since the WPA. And it was money given to all the states and hence then all the counties to respond to proposals from their community to create jobs. And Susan Bell wanted me to propose to set up a Artists and Writers Guild of Mendocino County, because there were so many artists pouring into the little communities all around Mendocino County. And she thought it would be a really good idea. And I think her colleagues at the time, Steve Caravello and Dan Hibschman, who were spending a lot of time with her at the community center, who were both artists, and they I think they had been talking about it. And so she said, Catherine, she always called me Catherine, Catherine, you write this CETA grant, and then you can run the Artists and Writers Guild. And I thought, because I'd been writing grants for the in-schools theater program in Illinois, I knew how to tackle that. And it wasn't a very difficult grant. It was just basically saying, here's what we want to do, and here's how much money it's going to cost. Not very much. And we took it to the Board of Supervisors, and I remember Jim Eddy was the deciding vote. And boom, I had a job. Didn't pay a lot, but it paid enough. And I had a place to stay with the woman I knew and from Laguna Beach, and she was in Ukiah, and she let me stay in her house. And then within minutes, practically, maybe a couple of weeks, I met a group of people who wanted to put on a play, and we did, and that was The Importance of Being Earnest, the summer of 1977, and we started Ukiah Players Theater. And there went my life, unfurling ahead of me. That's what I went and did for the next 40 years.
Is there a particular memory from Greenfield that's especially emblematic of the experience for you?
Well, I remember one night that first summer of 73, Bob and I had planted a couple marijuana plants that were, you know, kind of soldiering on. They weren't doing great because we were hauling water to them. They weren't burgeoning, but they were okay, and we were looking forward to that. And one night, it was a hot, hot, hot August, maybe September night, late in the season. They were beginning, it must have been September, early October. They're getting ready to be harvested. And we could hear across the little valleys of Greenfield, drumming going on and like some party going on somewhere. And we were in our teepee still. And it was like a very kind of like a odd, curious kind of primitive feeling night. And in the morning, the plants were gone. They'd been harvested by somebody. Somebody had found them and taken the plants. And that was, I remember, there's a downside. That was unfortunate. But one of my favorite memories of Greenfield is it was the fall of 1975, and I was living at the house, at our little cabin, with a friend of mine from Woodstock who joined us at Greenfield, a friend named Jane. Bob Currier at that time was working on a forest restoration project that New Growth Forest Service was doing at the time, really cool forest restoration project. And this was in the Ventana Wilderness by Big Sur. So he was gone, and Jane and I were holding down the fort, and there was going to be a big Halloween party at the ranch house. And someone had brought me some peyote buttons from somewhere and given them to me. And I decided that for the week before Halloween, I would steep those buttons in water. I'd make a tea, a peyote tea, on the wood stove in the cabin for a week, just kind of quietly let them steep, boil, you know, simmer. And I fasted that whole time. And while I fasted, I made a costume for the Halloween party. And my sister had sent me this old velvet vest with like velvet leaves and dark ruby colors. And it had little old ancient lace on it. And I made a little tiny little skirt. And I had little teeny tiny little tights, some kind of tights. But I attached to the skirt with embroidery thread, I sewed on on these strings of embroidery. I wove bay leaves and madrone berries and hung them from the skirt. And I had a little hat with a feather in it, and I decided I was a bird in a tree. And when it was getting time to walk down to the ranch house, I drank the tea, and I began to feel electric. And my friend Ross Walker, who had lived in Laguna Beach with us and had actually gone to UC Irvine with Bob and myself earlier, he had come and joined us and lived at the ranch. And he was living in a little cabin just above our house. And he came down to meet me at our cabin, and we were going to walk down together. And there was a full moon. And he had a guitar. And he came, and he was playing his guitar under the full moon on the ridge, waiting for me to come outside to join him to walk down. And I walked out as my little bird in a tree, and the bay leaf, the bay laurel trees and the oak trees all around me just kind of like leapt to attention, or that's how it felt to me, and spoke to me and said, "What do you think you're doing? You have just called to you all of this elemental power. You know, you are now, you are of us, you are made out of us, and you had better be responsible for what you're doing and what you're calling into being, into existence. And, you know, you're welcome. We welcome you, but just stay awake, pay attention, and realize what realm you've stepped into." It was the most amazing feeling. And we what do deer do? We weren't exactly leaping, but we were certainly cantering downhill all the way to the ranch house. And we had a great night at the ranch house with a group of people singing and telling stories. And then at about midnight, it was time to go home. And I remember feeling again, still like a little deer or a gazelle. And I kind of leapt up, kind of straight up this hill several miles, leapt back up to the cabin and went to sleep happily, and woke up in the morning with not a shred of hangover or feeling of grogginess from my peyote tea and my whole experience. But it was the loveliest psychedelic experience I've ever had.
What effect do you think that your experience on Greenfield has had on your life now that you've been away from it for so long after you decided to leave it?
Well, certainly it was what got me here, so I will be forever grateful for that. I remember one of my sisters came to visit me right after we'd built the cabin and in the fall of 73, and she came driving up. I was with her in a little Volkswagen. I must have met her. I can't remember how it worked out, but we were both driving up in her little car. I was showing her where I lived, and I remember as we approached the house over the ridge, in our road, Bob and I had named it Fred McMurray Lane, and that's what it's called now in the county books. It's Fred McMurray Lane. We approached the little cabin, and she said, "This is wonderful, but this is just a stepping stone. This is just a stop for you." And this was, of course, right about when the finger in my throat was beginning to make an appearance, and I didn't understand what she meant, except for later that kind of echoed in my mind. It was that I may not have to live here all of my life. It's served its purpose almost already to get me here, to get me to meet the people that I've met, the really remarkable people who were my neighbors and colleagues on Greenfield, who are still dear friends. But that sense of opportunity, the sense of freedom, a sense of the beauty of the land, the space of it, the geographic space, but beyond that, and this has continued for me, this sense of imaginative space and this message came to me later that there anything I want, literally this message came to me out of the sky, a voice from the sky came and said to me, "Whatever you want to create here, you can create. It's up to you. It's, you know, your imagination is your, you know, is the limit." And it's because, and this was the second part of the message, it's because of the people who are here. So that there are enough other people here who have the same kinds of ideas and dreams and vision that you have, that if you want to make something, you will be able to do that. Which was just what I didn't feel in Woodstock, Illinois, which is a lovely little town, fabulous little town with a 19th century opera house on the square. And that's where I got to play as a little girl and kind of cut my teeth in theater. But whenever I would go back to Woodstock and, you know, and stay there for any amount of time, I always had the sense that the ceiling was really low and I had to kind of duck because people weren't able to see very far. You know, there was only so far that they would allow themselves to imagine what could be, which was, you know, just the opposite here. It was this sense of anything is possible, and you know, it's not just because of the you know, we're on the edge of the country, but because of the people who are also here. And not only the people who came, but the people who are already here. There was a great, I mean, there was a tension between the community that was already here and those of us who kind of poured in, unkempt and, you know, and with our food stamps. I remember having my food stamps before I had a job, having my food stamps and being at the old Safeway, which was at the same place where it is now in Ukiah, but it was oriented west, and it was a little building. But I was there, and I was in line with Jane, and we were in whatever we were in, our little scruffy little tank tops, and who knows what. But it wasn't, whatever it was, the young man behind the counter who was checking us out, by the time it came up to us, it was our turn, and we unloaded our, you know, our groceries that we wanted to get, and we plunked our food stamps down. The young man turned to his friend who was bagging our orders and said, "Oh, I could have told you they'd have food stamps." And I remember feeling embarrassed, humiliated, angry, and thought, "How? How did you know? Why am I so different?" And I thought, "Yeah, we are. We are different from, you know, a lot of the people who are here." But as I've spent more time in Ukiah and got to know more people here, the great generosity of spirit of the people who are here, who wanted to help, you know, once I started doing theater, the people who wanted to help and be involved and support us and donate, and just really appreciated the fact that there was new energy and new ideas. This experiment, this, you know, kind of this hapless experiment, because no one really looked at it as even a movement. It was just a gut reaction to what was going on in the world that drove people here, I think, brought us, so many of us here. But that this thing that continues to happen here in Mendocino County, the creativity of this county and the resilience of this county and the activism of this county, that couldn't have happened without the agreement and the relationship with the people who are already here and what they already knew and what they'd already gone through, you know, the hardship and the challenges that they'd faced and the battles that they'd won. I think there was an affiliation and a mutual appreciation that has made this county stick together, you know, and continue to operate.
Was there a downside to the experience at all?
Yeah. You know, there hasn't been a personal downside for me. I feel like I've been able to. It's a really remarkable feeling. It's like when I was in college in the theater department at Irvine, it was a really good professional theater department, and everybody there knew, you know, that he or she was headed for L.A. or New York, and that's what they were going to do. And I remember sitting in those classes and thinking, seeing in my mind's eye, you know, like trying to project myself, you know, into living in New York or living in L.A. and having my 8x10 glossy that I was schlepping around to people. And I remember just at one point seeing a line across, you know, like, not, that's not going to happen, no. But there wasn't any other path at that time. There, you know, regional theater was just beginning. I wasn't hearing about it. Nobody was suggesting that, you know, that anything else was valid. And so when I came to Greenfield, I thought, well, I'm never going to do theater again. That's, you know, that's not going to be part of my life. And so then kind of tumble into it as deeply and you know, totally as I did was not an expectation that I had. And it just grew. And I've been able, being here, interestingly enough, you know, I've been able to do anything that I've wanted to do. I've been able to play any part I wanted to play. That's what you get to do when you're in a, you know, in a little community. But it, you know, it has felt important to me. It has felt, and I've been able to, you know, to direct people in really remarkable, you know, stories. And I've been able to literally help people tell their stories and that it's been as satisfying, you know, a kind of a life and work that I could have ever imagined. I've been so fortunate, And it's interesting listening to these other stories that I've had as I've been interviewing other people. That's a refrain that I continue to hear. And, you know, it may just be because of the people I've been talking to, you know, early on, but I'll be interested to see if other people have had that sense that, that of all places, this place has been that kind of a match to your one's inner self, to who you were to become. So I've had that opportunity. I mean, a downside, I think, we didn't change the world, obviously. You know, we didn't remake, you know, the world in our image. There's, you know, it's this is a very difficult time in our cultural life, you know, in this country. This is, who would have thought, you know, who would have thought we'd be where we are now in, you know, 2018 politically and you know, there's a great inequity, you know, and economically we know all the downsides that's happening in the big scale, but you know, and as a community, as a county, we're working that out here too. You know, there's a lot that needs to be done, that, you know, just having you know, like the will to work hard and, you know, loving each other and, you know, and eating well, you know, and that hasn't solved, you know, some of the big, big issues that we have in front of us. But the feeling, that sense of can do, that sense of appreciation for where you are and who you're with, that I think goes a long way to giving us the energy continually here in the county to say, but we can, it's going to make me want to cry, we can address it. We can do it. You know, we have the intelligence. You know, we really can. We have the inner resources. We can solve this. You know, we may not be able to solve it for the country. We may not be able to solve it for, you know, Iran, but we can solve issues for ourselves here. And that's what I want to jumpstart that reminder. I want us to recognize, you know, what we have done and that what is left to be done, you know, what's still in front of us, we can tackle, and we can tackle with goodwill and good spirit and intelligence.
We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Kate Magruder as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45 and 8:45, and one more time at 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.